United States v. Yarubi. Mr. Beal.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, the operative facts in this case are fairly straightforward. The defendant learned that the police were after him, and he must have assumed that at some point he would be charged with a crime, although there was no finding that he knew whether he already had been charged with a crime.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Beal. You have focused a lot at the front end of his behavior as these events are unfolding. But as I understand the record, he winds up getting arrested in Amsterdam in July 2010, and he's put in extradition proceedings where the United States is asking the government of the Netherlands to extradite him. And he lies, and he says he's not the same person, and he somehow manages to drag that process out for a year or so. And I don't know why that isn't enough to support the obstruction enhancement. He's certainly the U.S. and it's after arrest. I mean, all of the things that you're focusing on, I wonder if it even matters in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. The Amsterdam proceedings, there's no indication that he went through anything other than normal Amsterdam extradition proceedings. He had
but
a lawyer.
But he lies. He says, I'm not the same person as the guy who's wanted in the U.S.
Well, no, we don't have any of the records from Amsterdam. And this is a case, Mr. Indurabe has a number of names.
I'm not sure that's a plus, but yes.
I understand that perspective, but he has the name he has in this case. He went back to Nigeria using another name because he had to have a passport to get back to
That's
Nigeria.
That's the phony passport, yeah.
It's a Nigerian passport.
Fleeing the country is obstruction of justice.
Excuse me, Judge?
I think fleeing the country is obstruction of justice.
Well, that depends on how you read the guideline.
Look. If you flee the country, you put the government to a big expense in catching you, right? That's what obstruction of justice is, making it harder for the government to apprehend a person. Right?
Well, I think it depends on the point in time in which you flee.
I don't. Why? Why should that depend on it? The point is you obstruct justice when you deliberately, knowing what you're doing, you make it more difficult for the government to catch you, right? Why isn't that obstruction of justice?
Because ordinarily, as the guideline application note recognizes, simply fleeing from the police is not obstruction.
Why? And why isn't it obstruction?
Well, because he's going home. Now, if he happened to live in...
He's going home, but he knows the police are trying to arrest him.
But if
he's fleeing.
Yes, but if he... Well, first of all...
He's resisting arrest, right?
Well, he's not resisting arrest. He's never been in the presence of the police. He's
one step ahead of them, I'll give you that.
And, I mean, the point is, if he lived in Skokie, he'd hop on the CTA. But
doesn't make any sense. Look, he is making it more costly for the police and the law enforcement system to apprehend him. Now, why isn't that the very definition of obstructing justice?
Because we have a guideline that says if you do it before you're in the system in any way, it shouldn't count.
And then say that. It says ordinarily, you know, panicky, spontaneous flight. I don't agree with that, but I don't think this is... The Draves case, I mean, all right, the guy runs away from the police and he's caught a few seconds later. Now, you could say, well... He shouldn't have done that, but he didn't actually make it more costly for the government to apprehend and prosecute him because they caught him within seconds. That's fine, okay? But this guy, by him fleeing across to Nigeria and then Amsterdam, he's making it significantly more costly for the government, and that's obstruction of justice.
He is making it more costly for the government.
Well, give me a sensible reason why it shouldn't be considered obstruction of justice.
Because the basic precept that flight from the police, if you haven't been involved in the system and made any kind of commitment to the system.
What does that mean, a commitment to the system?
There's a huge amount of international crime at this point, and the government, with some regularity, needs to find people in other countries. So fleeing the country doesn't mean that you don't have accountability to the legal system of the United States.
Right, but the question is, how does this enhancement apply?
And he went to a lot of trouble to make it expensive and difficult. He was hoping to slip through the noose altogether.
Oh, absolutely. This court obviously...
Graves' case is readily distinguishable.
But you
don't see that. We have nothing further to discuss.
No, what I see you as disagreeing with are the Second, Ninth, and Eleventh Circuits.
Oh, no, even the Second Circuit has recognized that instinctual flight can ripen into a willful, attempt to impede or obstruct.
But in the Bliss case...
What is that Gonzalez case? It's United States.
In the Bliss case, he goes home in Vermont. His mom says, the police just searched your room. He says, can I have the car to go to the police station? Jumps in the car, drives to Bradley Airport in Connecticut, hops on a plane, goes to California, lives there for a year under assumed name. They finally track him down. I think they put him on the 10 most wanted or something. And the Second Circuit says that's not.
Well, that's absurd.
Well.
So I'm saying you disagree with the Second Circuit.
Well,
obviously.
That's absurd. You give me an explanation for why that is an obstruction of justice.
Yeah, he lied to his mother.
What's the sense of it? Now, maybe the law is just, insane. But what is the sense of saying that when he flees to California and he hides out for a year and puts the government to substantial expense, that's not obstructing justice?
I mean, what you're saying...
isn't obstructing justice. As a matter of
Your Honor, there's no precept that you've got to turn yourself in.
Well, there's a difference between not turning yourself in, and going and hiding. Well, don't you see the difference?
But
you don't see the difference.
I'm not saying there isn't a difference.
All right, so there's a difference. So let's talk about the hiding case, not the not turning yourself in case. Now tell me why that isn't obstruction of justice.
Well, because Mr. Indurabe happens to
be... No, we're talking about the California case. Why isn't that obstructing justice?
Other than the fact the Second Circuit says so. Because
that's not a reason.
I'm
precedent.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
So don't
kid me. Because it's the perspective that you don't have to turn yourself in. I mean,
there's a difference between not turning yourself in and hiding.
So if you
don't you see that?
Well, if you hid in Chicago or a suburb, you could just as effectively avoid the police.
And you'd be obstructing justice then too.
The idea is you have to go home and wait for the police.
I mean, that's exactly the point, which is, where do you draw the line? And
it's very easy. You draw the line where you're imposing a substantial burden on the government, because you're hiding, or you've fled to another state and you're hiding out there. You've gone to another country, or you're operating under multiple different names and multiple passports.
So if you commit a crime, I mean, I don't mean to be
say
cheap.
If
no,
why you think that is not obstruction of justice?
Because the defendant committed a crime, found out the police were after him, and took off. And that's the guideline says, if you simply take off.
We're not talking about simply take. You refuse to engage the question. Going and hiding is not simply taking off. It's taking off and then hiding. Now, why is it the hiding, not obstruction of justice?
Well, my answer is that I'm relying on the text of the guideline, which draws a distinction between...
There's nothing about hiding in the text of the guideline.
Right, but it says that when you've been arrested, when you've become involved in the system, and then you violate your commitment. And Mr. Indurabe had no commitment to anyone, and he fled to where he happened to be from. I mean, I understand that
Amsterdam?
This is not... excuse me?
Eventually Amsterdam?
And if, that's right. First to Nigeria for about 6 months, and then...
He's fleeing around a lot, isn't he?
Well, economic opportunities in Nigeria are very limited. There are a lot... He was in Amsterdam for 2 years and got in no trouble, as far as anybody's aware. He had greater economic opportunities. There's no indication he was dealing drugs.
His only trouble is he was caught there.
Yes, that was his unfortunate for him. But I'm just saying the text of the guideline.
No, the text doesn't say anything about hiding in Nigeria
or Amsterdam.
Well,
okay, thank you, Mr. Bill. So, Ms. Perry.
Good morning. May it please the Court, April Perry on behalf of the appellee, the United States of America. I just want to respond briefly to 2 points unless the Court has any questions.
I actually do have a question, though. I mean, we can draw a dichotomy between turning yourself in and hiding, but is there any middle ground? Like the minute you commit a crime, if you don't immediately walk into the first police station you find, are you, in effect, hiding?
Absolutely not, Judge. I think the distinction is in the willfulness requirement. There is a scienter requirement here, which requires that you not only know about a proceeding, but that it is your intent to avoid that proceeding and to avoid the judicial process altogether by requiring that willfulness.
So that does imply some duty on your part, if you know that the police are after you, to make it easier for them to catch you.
Not necessarily to make it easier, but not to go to the great lengths, especially that the defendant went to here.
Well, Judge Posner has suggested a substantial cost rule. So that suggests that there are some insubstantial costs that is fair game for you to impose on the government. Not, I would say, well represented by this case, but trying to think of the distance. I mean, so what? At what point have you crossed the line such that a sentencing enhancement, because we aren't really talking about independent liability, we're just talking about a more severe sentence. When do you cross that line?
Judge Posner's substantial cost rule is very helpful when it comes to showing that actual obstruction has occurred. But remember that the guideline also would criminalize or penalize attempted obstruction. So for attempted obstruction, perhaps the substantial cost rule, it does not get us all the way there because perhaps the defendant intended to put us to substantial cost, but it didn't happen. But certainly when there is substantial cost, it demonstrates that actual obstruction did occur. As in this case, when Your Honor asked about the Amsterdam proceedings, there isn't a lot about the record in the record about those, but certainly the government, if the case
was...
What
is in the record about those? I was curious that the government didn't say whatever one's duties are in the pre-arrest stage, once he's been arrested in Amsterdam and he's in the extradition proceedings, my understanding from your brief is that he was obstructive in those proceedings, but I don't know what is in the record about them.
There is not an enormous amount in the record about them. What is in the record is the government sentencing submission, which is at 486 in the docket, as well as the oral statements of the prosecutor at the sentencing, which proffer the facts that the defendant used a different name while in the Amsterdam proceedings.
So there's no affidavit from anybody representing the United States who was there or any statement from the Dutch court that handled it?
There is not. It would have had to have been the AUSA who is at the sentencing who would have had to have proffered those facts, which of course makes it difficult when it comes to being a witness in your own proceedings. Were the case to be remanded, I certainly could go forward with an affidavit or other documents from the Dutch court. But because all of this is occurring via the United States prosecutor and the Dutch prosecutors, what we have is email traffic back and forth. Ultimately, what we have is the Dutch order, which is still in Dutch, but which has the name that is not the defendant's name here.
Dutch isn't that hard. It's very close to German. It's halfway between German and English.
Well, it would be hard for me. but that could be done if the court wanted further factual findings on these issues. But I will say there was no objection to that fact at the district court level. It was both proffered in the government submission and orally. The defense never disputed at that time that he used a false name when he was going through the Dutch extradition proceedings.
And at the conclusion of those proceedings, is it the case that he's then turned over to the custody of U.S. Marshals to come back, or is it the Dutch authorities who bring him?
No, it is the U.S. Marshals in this case who had to go collect him from the Netherlands. He was held for about 11 months. During the time, he appealed several times. And then ultimately, once the Supreme Court or their version of the Supreme Court opinion came down, he was turned over to two U.S. Marshals who were based in Chicago.
Had to fly to Amsterdam. Maybe they had enough time to visit the Rijksmuseum.
The only other issue I wanted to address is this issue with respect to the Second and Eleventh Circuit cases. Those are in tension with the Seventh Circuit cases. However, this Court has already indicated that it does not follow those cases. Specifically, in Porter, it cited the Eleventh Circuit case following a but-see, indicating that this Court was well aware that there was other case law out there and still felt that this calculated evasion test was appropriate. For all of the reasons stated in our brief, we therefore would ask that this Court affirm the conviction and sentence of Defendant Enderibe.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Perry.
Thank you.
Mr. Beal, your time had expired, but if you have anything further, we can give you a moment. Pardon?
I have nothing further.
Okay, and you were appointed, were you not?
May I ask?
Judge Rogan has a question.
Okay, I have a sense of deja vu, Ms. Perry and Mr. Beal. And so, in open court, I can ask you this question, I think. How is Mr. Funches doing?
He's doing very well, thank you, Judge.
Okay.
He was exceedingly relieved and is back working very productively.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case for our